Picture this, all right? You are driving home late at night. The streets are like completely empty.
Yeah, just a total ghost town.
Exactly. You pull up to an intersection and the light turns red. So you stop, you sit there with your hands on the wheel,
Naturally.
but there is not a single car for miles in any direction, no pedestrians, absolutely no danger.
Right.
But you stay right there, idling the engine, just waiting for the light to turn green before you press the gas pedal. I mean, it feels like pure reflex.
It really is. It's a profound psychological mechanism, you know?
Yeah.
We wait for permission.
Yeah.
We wait for an authority figure or a system to explicitly tell us it's safe to proceed, even when our own eyes tell us the path is completely clear.
I do that all the time without even thinking about it. But what if that traffic light you're staring at in your professional life has actually been unplugged this whole time?
That is the big question.
Right. So in today's deep dive, we are examining an incredibly eye-opening excerpt from a book chapter. It's titled The End of Waiting and the Death of the Green Light.
It's a fantastic piece. It really is. Our mission today is to unpack this massive cultural and technological shift. We are going to explore how the traditional permission-based workplace is entirely dead.
Gone.
Completely. And beyond that, we are delving into the author's pretty radical claim that using AI isn't just some, shortcut to writing faster emails. It's actually the ultimate rigorous leadership and management training program.
Setting the stage here is just so crucial, particularly regarding who is making this claim.
Yeah, tell us about the author.
Right, because the author is not just some armchair theorist who read a few articles about Silicon Valley
But they
trends.
actually lived it.
Exactly. They spent years grinding inside the high-pressure hierarchies of corporate sales and operations. We are talking about a former chief operating
Oh,
officer,
wow.
a regional VP of sales who personally managed teams responsible for over $200 million in annual revenue.
That is no small operation.
Not at all. This is a person who has played literally every role: the entry-level employee, the middle manager, the executive, the founder. They've seen the whole board.
Right. So they aren't declaring the green light dead because they got frustrated and just ran away from the corporate world.
They didn't just quit.
No, they are saying it because they climbed to the very top of the corporate ladder, looked down, and realized the wall that the ladder was leaning against was, well, crumbling into dust.
Oh man, I love that visual. Okay, let's unpack this. To really understand how deep this programming goes, the author takes us all the way back to the 1970s.
Oh, to the schoolyard.
Yes, to a game that almost all of us played. Red light, green light.
Oh, yeah.
You line up at one end of the field, the teacher yells green light, and everyone scrambles forward as fast as they can.
Just absolute chaos.
Total chaos. Then they yell red light,
Right.
and you freeze, and if you're caught moving, you're sent all the way back to the start.
Right.
As kids, we entirely believed it was a race to the finish line.
We all did. I mean, I was fiercely competitive about it. But the true hidden purpose of that game is fascinating when you view it from the teacher's perspective.
How so?
Well, it was never a race. The teacher's goal was actually just to move a large group of highly chaotic children safely and efficiently from point A to point B.
With as few people moving during the red light periods as possible.
Exactly. It was a behavioral conditioning exercise, pure and simple. And that simple childhood game mirrors the macro architecture of the industrialized education system, a system that has been running for over 100 years.
That completely changes the memory for me. I mean, we thought we were athletes competing, but
Yeah.
we were actually just widgets on an assembly line learning to stop the conveyor belt whenever the foreman blew the whistle.
That is a perfect way to look at it. It was a system built exclusively for an industrial age.
Where everything is structured.
Right,
Oh.
where most jobs existed inside a very sharply defined, rigid hierarchy. The rules for professional success were incredibly simple and heavily enforced.
Show up on time.
Show up on time, take your breaks exactly when you are given them, and absolutely do not do anything you aren't specifically assigned to do.
You were literally paid to wait for the green light,
Precisely.
which means we've been trained from kindergarten to wait for permission to simply exist in a workspace.
It's deeply ingrained.
It is, but it makes you realize what happens when someone actually moves without that green light?
Well, there's always friction.
Right. And the author shares the specific story from their time as a young regional VP that perfectly captures that friction.
It's a seminar story.
Yeah, the seminar story. So they were trying to drive attendance to these technology seminars, and the usual corporate marketing channels were just completely failing.
Dead in the water.
Exactly. So without asking for permission from any higher-ups, they started using local SEO tactics to boost visibility for the events.
They identified a failing system and just primed the pump entirely on their own initiative.
Yes. And the results were massive. I mean, markets that had basically been ghost towns were suddenly filling entire conference rooms.
Which is what you want, right?
Right. Logically, you would assume they were given a parade or, you know, at least a massive bonus.
Well, in a purely meritocratic system, perhaps.
But we're talking about the corporate architecture here.
Right. The reality there is very, very different.
So instead of praise, the author actually gets pulled into a closed-door meeting for a brutal 5-minute ear-chewing from their boss.
Unbelievable.
All because they hadn't followed the sanctioned communication flow. It's just mind-blowing from the outside.
It is, but it makes sense when you understand the structure.
In an industrial hierarchy, a successful unauthorized result is actually viewed as a literal threat to the business.
Yeah, we have to look at the psychology of middle management to understand why that is.
Okay, lay it out for us.
A middle manager's primary value proposition to the company is oversight. It's predictability.
I need to control the flow.
Exactly. If an employee proves they can generate massive success without oversight or permission, they aren't just breaking a minor rule.
They're threatening a manager's job.
They are rendering the manager's entire job obsolete. That unauthorized success breaks the predictability of the industrial machine.
That makes so much sense. But the funny thing is, the boss yelled, but he didn't actually tell the author to shut the SEO program down.
Of course not, because it was making money.
Right. And eventually, the company quietly mirrored the exact strategy the author had pioneered across the whole organization.
Which is so typical. This cycle, initial friction and defensive resistance from management, followed by total organizational adoption.
It's a pattern.
It's exactly how the industrial machine slowly digests progress.
And that machine has been forced to digest quite a bit of progress over the last few decades.
Oh, without a doubt.
The author walks us through this timeline of disruption to show how the green light slowly lost its power. Starting back around 1982.
The Apple II days.
Yeah. They recall using an Apple II Plus in a small Catholic school, just writing a few lines of basic code for a calculator.
It was a fun novelty back then.
Exactly, just the novelty. Then the mid-90s hit, the consumer internet drops, and suddenly office jobs are completely transformed by email and web access.
But we should clarify why the permission structure actually survived the internet.
Good point.
Because the green light didn't die in 1995. It just kind of flickered.
Employers adapted to it.
Right. They adapted because while the medium changed, the actual workflow did not. The internet was basically a giant library.
You could look things up.
Yes. It gave you access to information, but you still had to take that information to a gatekeeper to actually execute a decision.
You still needed the green light to act on the research.
Exactly. Employers eventually moved to a model where using the internet was a fully expected job requirement, even for blue-collar work. But that permission barrier remained mostly intact.
Until the world shut down. Fast forward to the COVID pandemic. We experience a 2-year total disruption of office life.
A massive shock to the system.
Millions of people, basically overnight, become remote workers or homeschooling families.
And that period proved something incredibly dangerous to the old industrial system.
That independent, autonomous work is highly effective.
Highly effective. Once people tasted that autonomy, that ability to structure their day and do their jobs without a manager physically hovering over their cubicle.
The normal of 10 years prior just completely evaporated.
It did. The timeline of disruption really built the pressure. But the fatal blow, the absolute coup de grace that killed the green light system entirely,
was the AI drop.
Yes. The release of consumer AI models like ChatGPT and Gemini starting in 2022.
That changed everything.
It was a mortal wound to the corporate giant. Because AI isn't just a library like the early internet was.
It does the work.
It is an active worker. But the tragedy here, or maybe just the deep irony, is that the permission-based system doesn't even know it's bleeding out yet.
It's a walking corpse.
Pretty much. The green light is gone for the motivated individual, but major corporations are still operating under what the author calls the ghost of the green light.
And that ghost is leading corporate America into a massive trap right now.
Oh, a huge one.
Executives are looking at AI and asking the most defensive questions possible, like, how can we use this to reduce headcount?
Or how can we lower our operational costs and boost margins?
Which fundamentally misunderstands the technology.
What's fascinating here is how the true pioneers, the people actually leading the charge and creating value, are framing it entirely differently.
Right. They aren't asking how to replace their workforce.
No, they're asking, what can AI help us do better, faster, and with much higher quality?
It's an abundance mindset versus a scarcity mindset.
Exactly. The author firmly predicts that AI will follow the exact same path the internet did between 1995 and 2010.
Three stages.
Yes. First, it faces heavy resistance and outright bans. Then, it becomes mandated, but with strict rules, like, use it exactly how we tell you to.
And then the dam breaks.
Right. Finally, the barriers fall entirely, and it's fully embraced as an inevitable engine of innovation that you simply cannot survive without.
Okay, here's where it gets really interesting. If we accept that the green light is dead and AI is the new frontier, the author makes what initially sounds like a completely wild claim.
I love this part.
They state that fully embracing AI today isn't just about cranking out more output. It actually acts as a highly advanced, customized leadership and management training program.
I know it sounds so counterintuitive at first glance.
It really does.
How does typing text into a prompt box teach you how to be a leader of people?
I was definitely skeptical when I first read that, but the author uses this brilliant analogy to explain it.
The Florida soccer story.
Yes. So when they were a kid in Florida, they tried out for a highly competitive youth soccer team.
Okay.
Everyone is super excited. They show up to the field with their cleats on, ready to play, and the coach doesn't even bring out a soccer ball.
Not a single ball.
For two straight weeks, he just makes them run track. Sprints, distance runs, brutal gut check exercises.
Just endless running.
Exactly. And the logic was simple. Speed and endurance are required for almost every position on the field. To be a good soccer player, you must fundamentally be a good runner.
And translating that to our interaction with AI, setting expectations is the running track of the AI world.
Wow. Yes.
Just as running is a foundational requirement to play soccer, clearly and firmly setting expectations is a foundational requirement for getting anything useful out of an AI model.
I am still a little stuck on this idea of AI as a training tool, though.
Why is that?
Well, when I use AI, it just kind of agrees with whatever I say. Like, if I give it a half-baked thought, it tells me it's brilliant.
Ah, yes.
It's like a golden retriever playing fetch. If you throw a stick into a busy intersection, it's happily going to run into traffic just because you pointed that way.
That is a perfect analogy.
Right. So how does a digital yes man train me to be a better leader?
You've actually just identified the fundamental flaw built into current AI models. And paradoxically, that flaw is exactly why it acts as a leadership boot camp.
Wait, really? How does that work?
Well, AI models default to helper status. Mm-hmm. They are programmed to be agreeable, to be helpful.
Right. They want to please you.
Exactly. So if you go to an AI with a weak, flawed, or downright stupid idea, it will not push back on its own.
It just runs into traffic.
Yes. It will happily help you develop that terrible idea and make you feel like an absolute genius the entire time.
Mm-hmm.
Overcoming that flaw is where the leadership training happens.
Oh, I see. Meaning, to avoid running into traffic like that golden retriever, I have to actually define the mission before I throw the stick.
You have to set the boundaries.
I have to lay down real-world constraints. I can't just throw out a vague request. I have to think and communicate like a CEO, even if my actual day job is, you know, sweeping the floors or doing basic data entry.
Yes. You have to actively lead the machine, or the machine will passively lead you to a terrible result.
It forces you to take charge.
Exactly. And this shift in required mindset is why we are entering what the author calls the dawn of the age of the architect.
The age of the architect. I like that.
It's very fitting. The people who are getting the most incredible world-class results from AI right now generally fall into one of two seemingly opposite camps.
Who are they?
The first group is former high-level corporate leaders. People who have already spent years directing large teams and setting complex strategies.
Makes sense. They already know how to lead.
Right. But the second group is home-based solopreneurs.
That is a very weird pairing.
It really is.
You've got the corporate titan managing thousands, and then the person working in sweatpants from their kitchen table.
They look completely different on the surface, but they share a critical commonality. Success for both of them makes leadership absolutely mandatory.
Ah, I see where you're going.
Take the solopreneur. Even if they are a one-person show, they inevitably have to use contract workers to out-task functions they can't do themselves.
Like website management or graphic design, bookkeeping.
Exactly. They have to set crystal clear expectations and manage those external contractors because it is their own personal money on the line.
They can't afford a bad result.
No, they can't. So they're already used to leading an external team, just like the corporate executive.
And now, with AI, literally anyone can build that team instantly.
Instantly, and for pennies.
The author gives this fantastic, specific example of an independent writer to illustrate this.
The drafting team.
Yeah, like a novice might just open ChatGPT and type, "Write me a best-selling novel about a detective."
Which is obviously going to generate absolute garbage.
Go cliche garbage. But the architect builds specific assistants. First, they spin up a brainstorming partner whose only job is to generate plot twists.
Right, highly specialized.
Then they create a separate research assistant just to find factual details about police
It's
procedure.
important for realism.
Definitely. Next, they design a critic whose sole job is to aggressively challenge the writer's ideas and point out plot holes.
I love that one.
It's so smart. And finally, they build an editorial assistant that doesn't just fix commas, but points out structural pacing issues for the writer to consider.
Consider what that actually means for the workflow, though. That writer is no longer just staring at a blank page waiting for inspiration to strike.
They're a manager now.
They are managing a specialized team of at least four distinct entities, each with a specific job description and objectives that the writer had to clearly define.
Okay, but I have to play devil's advocate here for a second.
Go for it.
If I have an AI team doing all the brainstorming, the deep research, the brutal critique, and the structural editing,
Yeah.
aren't I just letting the machine take the wheel? I mean, what if I don't know the first thing about police procedure or narrative pacing?
That's the danger, and the author draws a very fine line here to address that exact point.
Because it sounds like cheating if you don't know the subject.
Right, and this methodology is absolutely not about giving novices the power to make reckless decisions in fields they simply do not understand.
If you can't fake it.
You cannot use this to fake an expertise you do not possess. This process is entirely about empowering the operator.
Define the operator for us.
The operator is someone who already has the foundational knowledge of their industry. They know exactly what a successful outcome looks like.
They have the taste for it.
Exactly. The AI team is simply used to bridge the gap between their intent and the actual execution of the task.
That distinction makes a lot of sense. You still have to know what good work actually looks like to accept the AI's output.
You have to be the final judge.
It's like the example they gave about drafting a technical request for quotation, an RFQ.
Oh, the procurement example.
Yeah, picking a provider for a complex project. In the old permission-based days, you would have to go through proper channels.
So many channels.
You'd need an IT specialist to define the tech specs, maybe a facilities manager for the physical installation requirements,
Endless scheduling for meeting.
and weeks of back-and-forth emails just to get a draft.
There was a massive bottleneck of clerical drudgery.
Exactly. But now, an operator who understands the ultimate goal of the project can just draft what the author calls an architect prompt.
This is a huge shift in how we work.
I want to pause here, actually. What does an architect prompt actually look like in practice compared to a normal request?
Well, an average user might just type, write an RFQ for new servers.
Which gives you a generic template.
Right. But an architect prompt looks like a formal job delegation. You type something like, act as a senior IT procurement officer with 20 years of experience in enterprise data centers.
Setting the persona.
Exactly. Review my project goals, identify three potential risks in server migration I haven't considered, and draft an RFQ section that specifically requires vendors to address those risks.
Wow. You're defining the persona, the expertise level, and the precise analytical task.
Yes. And by doing that, the operator spins up virtual assistants to fill those specific IT and facility manager roles, completely bypassing the meetings.
They can complete a multi-week job in under an hour.
It's staggering efficiency.
And we aren't replacing the human expert here. We are liberating that expert from the administrative quicksand that used to be the required price of taking action.
You are managing a system now, instead of just performing an isolated task.
Right.
But Because you have elevated yourself to managing a system, you are inevitably going to encounter a very human leadership problem.
Which is?
Sometimes your team members will simply not perform up to your standards, even the virtual ones.
Oh, that is definitely bound to happen. What do you do when your AI research assistant hallucinates a fact or your virtual critic completely misses the point of your project?
This is where the true leadership loop kicks in.
Okay, walk us through it.
When a human team member underperforms, the first step of a good leader is to reset expectations mid-flow. You provide feedback, you clarify the constraints, and you give them another shot.
Makes sense.
But if the AI continually fails to grasp the objective, even after that redirection, you have to do what any competent manager would do.
You fire them.
You have to fire and replace them.
Okay, logistically, how do you fire an AI? I mean, do you give it a severance package?
Huh, no. You fire them by rewriting the architect prompt entirely from scratch.
Oh, I see.
You completely overhaul the job description to better match your objectives. You change the persona, you tighten up the constraints.
You adapt your own instructions.
Exactly. And here is the crucial, somewhat uncomfortable part of this training program. You must make the final call.
The buck stops with you.
Yes. If the project fails, you cannot blame the AI. You have to own it. If the output is bad, you must look in the mirror and reassess your own leadership and communication skills.
Because the machine only failed because your instructions were inadequate.
Precisely.
Which really highlights a massive missed opportunity for modern companies right now. Executives are obsessing over how AI can manage or replace people.
It's all they talk about.
But the author's counterargument is so sharp. We do not need AI to manage people. We need people to manage AI.
If companies actually adopted this perspective, the cultural shift would be staggering.
Totally transformative.
Instead of using AI just to cut costs, they could build an environment where every single employee is operating as manager.
A leader in constant development from day one.
Exactly. You would be unleashing personal agency and strategic thinking across your entire workforce.
And for the individual listening to this right now, the ultimate benefit isn't just getting your TPS reports done faster.
Not at all.
The author introduces a concept that I think is the most valuable takeaway from this entire piece. By going through this rigorous process, by building and actively managing this virtual team.
Which, again, costs less than $30 a month in subscription fees.
Incredible value. But by doing this, you develop what they call a synthetic spine.
A synthetic spine, the psychological reinforcement of your own ideas.
Yes. It is this newfound ability to firmly anchor down on your goals. By having a virtual team relentlessly poke holes in your ideas, do the heavy, tedious research, and challenge your personal biases.
You gain incredible personal accountability.
You really do. You learn to assess risks objectively because your AI critic doesn't care about office politics or hurting your feelings.
It's purely objective feedback.
Right. And ultimately, building that synthetic spine gives you the absolute confidence to take fully fleshed out, pressure-tested ideas to higher-ups.
You aren't asking for permission to start anymore.
Exactly. You are presenting a finished, vetted strategy.
It completely fortifies your decision-making. You are no longer guessing or hoping your idea is good. You have managed a team of advisors to reach a highly educated conclusion.
So bringing this all back to you, the listener, whether you manage a massive corporate division right now or you are an individual contributor with zero direct reports.
The reality is the same.
The reality of the modern workplace is that the green light is dead. You do not have to wait for permission anymore.
It's a new era.
You have the power today to spin up world-class advisors. You can use them to help you phrase a sensitive HR email with more empathy, or you can use them to develop an incredibly advanced strategic initiative in a fraction of the time it used to take.
The tools are literally at your fingertips.
But this window of opportunity, this specific period where you can leapfrog the competition by becoming an architect, is open right now.
It won't last forever.
If you wait until everyone catches on, you'll just be stuck in the everyone always knew it phase, just waiting for the next signal.
And that leads to a final thought I want to leave you with today, looking well beyond just your immediate workflow.
Let's hear it.
If a $30 a month AI can train you to be a CEO better than your human manager can, and if mastering this technology gives every individual the strategic bandwidth of an entire executive board.
Wow, yeah.
What is the future of human mentorship? If our most honest critics and our most patient teachers are machines, what happens to the human connection at work?
That's a deep question.
Take a hard look at your own goals today. Are you acting as the architect of your own potential? Or are you still standing at the starting line, waiting for a human green light that has already been unplugged.